I decided when I was a high school sophomore that I was going to become a college biochemistry professor. So I knew exactly where my career was headed, clear through about halfway to my PhD, and had a unique opportunity for those days to visit some missionaries in a very remote setting and saw firsthand what it is like that to see what an experience and get to interact with the people that you'd only seen in pictures before. And so I that started me thinking about rethinking a little bit about career directions. My research was, the big picture was trying to understand how enzymes are able to take extremely unlikely reactions and make them happen with blistering speed. But we were at the very, very micro level of looking into that. We were looking into very tiny little models that would help us understand that. But while I was, I began wondering what would science look like, in particular, what might my career look like if it were designed specifically to help the extremely poor, the kinds of people that I had met there. That could be in the medical area, could be in the technology area, but I'm not gifted in the appropriate technology side of things. Or it could be in agriculture, and I had grown up on a farm that had been in the Price household in southeast Ohio for about 180 years. Appalachian subsistence farm myself. So I began wondering, What could it look like in agriculture? And I thought, a lot of opportunities in medicine. A biochemistry would be a good way to move into that. Probably fewer people make that move from agriculture. So what might it look like? And in particular, is God calling me to do that? And that raised all kinds of very practical theological issues for me. Does God call people to a particular thing? Does he just want me to do whatever many, many good possibilities that a person could spend their life doing? If he does call, how in the world do I figure it out? If any of you are going through that stage, you can send me an email and I'll give you a link to where I've written up the story of, it's sort of a personal case study of how I went along that path. Well, to make a long story short, I became a college biochemistry professor, but continued to be, plagued by the idea that I was supposed to find a way to use my career as a scientist to help the poor and to be involved with the Great Commission. And one night Geneva College, I'd been walking around praying about many things, and especially this, and saw something in the distance that reminded me of the place I'd been in the mountains in South America, and I started thinking about some of the houses that people lived in and what the families were like, and I began wondering, some of those people are Christians. The fact that I have a PhD and that I have a lot more money gives me absolutely no advantage on progress in godliness. If God hears my prayers about things that in comparison are probably kind of trivial, you could be sure he's going to be listening to theirs. So I began wondering, what would I be praying about if I were in this family's shoes? Probably there was a mud floor, not much I could do about that. I might be praying that somehow God would help my daughter to find enough firewood, because her job would be mainly going around trying to get firewood every day to cook the evening meal, and that God would keep her safe on the way back, both from robbers or for worse things, because sometimes young girls have to go quite a distance to get this firewood. I might be praying that enough corn would be harvested that we could sell some and buy a little bit, not only some other foods, but take care of some medical bills and maybe even send one of our kids to elementary school. And then the thought occurred to me, indeed, there are households and they are praying about this kind of thing. And could it be that this nagging thought of find a way to use science to help the poor and to be involved with missions is part of the way God is answering? Could it be that he's saying, Martin, you can do something about this as a scientist? So that, in a quick nutshell, is the end of a very long story that spread over about 12 years. So ECHO's vision statement for many years was this one: to bring glory to God and a blessing to mankind by using science and technology to help the poor. Now, to bring glory to God, that isn't just an obligatory religious word to put in there because we're a Christian organization. That was a prime motivation. And that means a lot more than just singing or worshiping. It has another sense of enhancing God's reputation among the people by the way that we live our lives and conduct ourselves in our profession. One of the key ways that we see the world at ECHO, where we're doing this kind of work using science to help the poor every day, is to think about options that are available to the poor. One of the biggest differences between the extremely poor and any one of us in this room is that we have a lot of options, and the extremely poor may have very few. For example, it was easy for Bonnie and me to afford coming to this conference. We could have driven one of our two cars, but instead we chose Delta Airlines. We have a lot of clothes. This little girl, it's hard to tell how many suits of clothes do you suppose she has. What age do you think she will get her first pair of shoes? Is there a chance she'll be able to go to school sometime? One thing you can tell already, that's not a very good, not the best picture, and the lights are too bright there, but can you see an orange tinge to her hair? That's telling us, without doing any blood tests or anything, that she's malnourished. That's when a brunette starts getting orange hair, that's the outward sign of inward biochemical changes from protein malnutrition. So the poor have very few options. So a big theme at ECHO, in fact, the title of our flagstone book is called Agricultural Options for the Poor, because after 32 years of doing this work, we have pulled together. Most of it's not things we invented, it's things we've learned about from countless missionaries and nationals around the world and scientists that we interact with, that we read about, that come to our conferences in the United States or other countries. And we're sort of a data center of networking people and information. I wanted to mention, in case some of you might be in the environmental sciences and have sometimes wondered, should you consider how you might be involved in environmental work and missions? I'm not aware of many missions that are specifically looking for an environmentalist. But many of them are looking for agriculturalists to help the peasant farmer. And what an agricultural missionary does is very similar to what an environmentalist would want to do. You want to reforest the hillside. You want to keep this forest from being cut down. You want to stop the sedimentation in the river and the pollution in the river. You want to reduce the use of pesticides. So if any of you are interested in pursuing that kind of discussion, my email address of me and all the other speakers are in the hand of your booklet, your guide. Okay, let's take one way to start looking for options and to understand what kinds of options are needed is to think more about the kinds of problems that people face. If you can't get a job, where can you go so that you can at least grow enough food for your family? Well, basically, you have to go to settings where people with money don't want. unless you happen to inherit a piece of land or something. The extremely poor are not going to borrow money and get a mortgage and buy a piece of land. Bonnie and I were driving down Exuma Island in the Bahamas, about maybe 1,000 miles out east of Florida. I'm not sure just how far, but every once in a while, the trees that we were going by would be cut back and you'd see a garden like this. This is actually someone's garden. You can see the banana stalks in the front. Over there at the right's a tomato plant. There's some other food plants being grown there. Many times we hear from people working in extremely arid regions. And what you want to do sometimes is say you shouldn't even be trying to grow food there. But we don't say that because we know the only reason they're there is because that's the only place that they can be. So we do what we can to look for options for people that are living in really, really dry places. Hopefully that won't be where you're living. You mentioned how dry it's getting there. How would you like to be one of the many farmers that own little terraces on this hillside? And just think what it would be like if you own two or three of those and you've got a good harvest in this particular place. Their main crop would be leeks, potatoes, onions. And you get a 50-pound bag of onions harvested. Okay, where do you think you're going to go? Maybe your house is way down here or way up there, and even when you get there, there's no market for it unless you happen to be lucky and be near a road. Think of the erosion problems. This farmer spent a lot of effort getting this hillside ready to plant some beans. I was just in Haiti last fall, right after Hurricane, the one that hit New England, had come through there and did all kinds of damage. And you could see there is a part of Haiti that's still forested, but every so often you could see exactly this kind of thing without the little erosion barriers that this farmer in Honduras had put in to try to at least stop some of the runoff. Livestock run free. These are the kinds of things that people face. So what I'm going to do is just tell you some real fast, almost story-like explanations of what some options are. What I would like you to do is to envision that you are going yourself to one of these countries. Places, whatever missionaries you've heard, somebody from the Peace Corps, something you could imagine. And you can imagine you're going to be there a month and you want to be able to suggest to the missionaries some things that they might want to do, or you're going to be there for a year or two and they've said, with all of your training, we'd like you to give the poor more options. The poor don't need to have so few options, but the options you give them have got to cost them almost nothing. And if it's to be sustainable, we don't want to pay much money for it either. First, I'll go show you three pictures just to give you a sense of what Echo International's U.S. office or farm is like. We're in Southwest Florida. We have 50 acres. We have the largest collection of useful tropical plants and subtropical plants that you would find in the United States, unless possibly there'd be one in Hawaii somewhere. We have 15,000 visitors a year come through to see them, and that's not counting the missionaries and the nationals that come through for training. And we've divided it into different climatic settings. One simulates a rainforest, hot, humid lowlands, semi-arid, monsoon climate, an urban jungle, you might say, where you have to do all your gardening on a cement slab. And we made what we call a mountain had to use sand. That's all we have to garden with there. And it's about as high as this. And people laugh at us from up north when they come through and we're so excited about our mountain. But we get a thrill when we go over an overpass that's so flat down there. We have both the common tropical plants that are here there for just for educational value and for our interns like Carolyn. We have 10 interns a year. An intern for us is a college grad who's ready to go overseas, but would like to have a year, I believe it's maybe 14 months now, These are paid, housing's provided, health insurance, limited browsing rights on the farm, and so imagine that you're there and trying to figure out how to help. So here's some examples. One problem is, a very common one, is that malaria is an extremely common disease. It can be recurrent. It can some kinds can be lethal. One man that often worked for ECHO, either as a volunteer or sometimes paid, went over to Liberia and died of cerebral malaria while he was over there. Drugs can be difficult to afford if you are extremely poor. And even if you aren't poor and you can get access to the drugs, you can't assume that there's any active ingredient in them. The United Nations sent a survey out in Southeast Asia. And the one part I remember, the worst case, was that in Cambodia, 52% of the drugs that their team of undercover went around and bought for malaria treatment, nicely packaged, beautiful, state-of-the-art drugs, had no active ingredient in it. And this continues to be a problem in third world countries even today, and even in our own country has to stay on high alert to avoid that. Artemisia is a plant that is the source of the chemical that is used in essentially the only drug today that will cure cerebral malaria. Now, we don't promote many medicinal plants. We're a science-based, Christian-based organization. We try to not talk about something unless we're pretty sure as scientists that the research has been done. Well, in this case, they know the exact mechanism, what the chemical is, the biochemical mechanism of how it kills the parasite. Acres of this are being grown to extract that active ingredient and make the drug. It's called Artemisia, and the drug is artemisinin. The beautiful thing about this is that you can make a tea out of the leaves. You can use them fresh, or you can dry them, and it's very bitter, so you better put some sugar or something in it. It's extremely bitter. Bitter is often a sign that people in impoverished countries take, as this will probably cure fevers, because that's the way alkaloids taste, and many alkaloids have biological effects. This is taken at ECHO in Florida. It's not readily grown in all parts of the world, but many parts of the world it is, and this could be, if every family had just one or two of these plants, it would meet all of their malaria needs. They don't recommend you use it prophylactically because that can end up in resistance to the malaria. But just use it when you need to. You can dry it and store it under good conditions. They've found that it still has the active ingredient for up to 3 years. So a lot more could be said about each of these, but I want to just give you a flavor of the incredible numbers of options that are out there for some of the problems. We got a letter several years ago from a woman in Illinois. She's going to be working with Wycliffe Bible Translators in Indonesia. And she said, my family's going with me, my husband, kids. We're not going to be agricultural missionaries, but I've been told that you can't grow vegetables in a rainforest. What in the world is my family going to eat? Because we know the importance of vegetables. Well, that was a fun one to answer. It was basically good news with some modified downs. The first bad news is that your friends are right. There's very little chance that the common vegetables you grow in Illinois will grow in a rainforest. Most of them would not grow in Florida in the summer right now. I wrote a publication on how to garden vegetables in Florida in the summer, but it didn't include things that you would be growing in, even up here in Nashville. But the good news is that what you need to do is grow the vegetables that God created for a rainforest, and there's some wonderful ones. The sort of downside to that one is you'll have to change your taste buds a little bit. And that's what we tell people in the summer in Florida. If you want to garden, grow some of the things like you would find in a rainforest. And even though they're strange to us, there's a lot of people growing food down there for nutrition centers and so forth. A lot of the immigrants, these are comfort foods that they're coming to. The person from up here might find them really strange. So, for example, instead of trying to grow the Irish potato, grow the tropical yam. Now, Southerners call sweet potatoes yams. This is not sweet potato. The international word for this is the yam. They have tubers about this big. They absolutely thrive during in rainforest-type climates. And it's about the same nutritional value as a potato, but at least gives you a lot of carbohydrate. A lot more nutritional value comes in the winged bean. Some people call this the supermarket on a stalk because you can eat the leaves like you would eat spinach. You can eat the pods like green beans. You can eat the seeds. You can eat the tubers, which have eight times the protein of an Irish potato. Was there one more? Yes. All right, the blossoms. Blossoms are actually very tasty. The National Academy of Sciences put this chart together some years ago based on it had to have been a paper study, but of all the food that humans consume in the world, how much comes from each of these different plants? They found that 95% of the food comes from 30 species of plant. And look what a small contribution the 30th most commonly eaten plant in the world is, mango. Another very interesting thing, not until you get to number 29 is there anything that would have been found in the continental United States when Indians first came to this continent. That was the sunflower seed. There was a grape of sorts, but it's not the grape that we mainly use. The muscadine type probably was here. Well, the National Academy of Sciences made the case that there are a lot of other foods. I would word it, God has created many kinds of foods. ECHO has published a book on 500 edible leaves that you can eat. And when I was doing postdoctoral research in agriculture at Purdue University, as I was moving along on this new career direction, I audited a course on tropical agriculture, and the professor mentioned this one day. There's some things that if it were a movie, there would be dramatic music to alert you to pay close attention, because this is going to be really big. This alerted us to a whole new world of things, which from day one has been a key idea at ECHO, that we want to write about these plants, the lesser known ones that have potential, encourage people to experiment with them. Not sure where I was going with that, but we want to write about them, but we don't want to write about them unless we can send them seed. There's no point in getting them interested in something, but say, eat your heart out, you're never going to get this wing bean. So sometimes we'll hold off on writing about something important until we can get seed and get it grown. We have a climate-controlled seed bank. It's not like the government, but it's not like a seed store either. We don't want to be a repeat. We don't want repeat customers. So that's not a seed store. If we would send that lady one or maybe six varieties of wing beans, that would be as many as we would have. And she plants them. If they grow, she could save seed. If people like them, they can keep growing them. Otherwise, just don't just throw it away or eat what you've got and forget about it. Thomas Jefferson said that the greatest service which can be rendered to any country is to add a useful plant to its culture. Now, there's always risks from adding a new plant, and we try to be very careful about that. But think about what you would eat if you ate the rest of this month only things native to the continental United States. Remember, the Indians brought corn and tomatoes and pumpkins and things like that, so you can't count those in your diet. Basic research can sometimes lead to very useful applications. I was doing basic research at Indiana University on the enzyme reaction mechanisms. Is my time about up? Okay. I couldn't remember when I started. I'll tell you about the underground forest. Tony Rinaldo was a missionary in West Africa. And he had this, the ancient people told him that there used to be forests here. But it had been cut down. The government had a big program to grow cotton. And so for years it looked like that. There were governmental programs designed to try to get these, to get it reforested. They had given him a big grant to do this. So he had started a tree nursery, and they'd distributed, they'd had food for work to get them planted. But what's the chance that a little seedling stuck in the ground like that, with goats and things running free, and drought is going to make it? So Tony was really discouraged. He'd been working there for, more than 12 years. And he told me that one day he was sitting in his Jeep, and this is what he was looking out over, and he noticed little clusters. You can see the man sitting, standing by a cluster, and he wondered, what is that? See, there's an insert of it closer up. And he looked at it and realized that I've seen these leaves. This is a tree leaf. And we called this the underground forest because those trees, many of them, were still alive. Every year they would try to send up, in this case, multiple trunks, would-be trunks, because they keep getting cut back. And so he said, what if we fenced in a little area and cut back to maybe one or two or three of these stems and see what happens? And before very long, he started getting trees. And by the end of a few years, trucks were coming into the area hauling wood products out of the area. The United Nations has an organization that looked for 10 of the best ideas in Africa that they would intensely verify. And this is one of them. We now call it farmer-managed natural regeneration. I'm going to speed through here to a couple. What do you do when only water you could drink comes from a stream like this? My wife, Bonnie, back here in the gray in the brown coat, has some bookmarks with contact information if you'd like to have them. Oh, she put them down there in that corner. The mission that she has worked with for 20 years stateside is about 1 mile from this stream, and this is where the ladies do the wash. You can imagine what's in that water, but there's times of the year where that's where the water has to come from. There's a seed of a tree from India called the moringa tree. If you pull off this outer black husk, you get a small little kernel. You can easily mash it. Put that in some water. On the far right is untreated water from a pond at Echo. On the left is one where we have put this, maybe about one moringa seed in that crud that you see on the left. The middle one is done by a totally different approach called a biosand filter. Within less than a day, all of the solids have settled out. I tried it with, I made some really bad, yucky stuff with mud and so forth. Poured it equally into two glasses, set them in front of a box so you could potentially read through it, and within 4 hours, you could read through that. Now, this gets rid of a lot of the microbes get trapped in the crud that falls to the bottom. This technique actually works better if there is crud there because that helps trap it. There's also antimicrobials that kill off the bacteria. There's still some left though, so you can do a treatment called SODIS. If you have clear water so the ultraviolet light can pass through it, you can leave these bottles in the maybe on a on a roof or a corrugated piece of roofing on the ground, preferably painted black. And within one day, they've done scientific studies that that will kill everything. They've even inoculated it with known human disease organisms. Okay, I think I'm out of time. I have nothing else to do but the rest of the afternoon. So if any of you want to stop by and talk to me about more of this or how we could help you.
A couple of questions, but then we have dinner at 5 o'clock and the ASA business meeting at 7. So any okay. quick questions here?
Yes.
We spoke with you a couple of days ago, Martin. I was down there garden jungle for a month, a couple of years ago, and I worked with the Quechua.
Yes. Yeah, it's a little bit like the story of the blind man feeling the elephant. The world is full of problems, and in Latin America especially, one of the big problems is the poor don't tend to like green vegetables much. A lot of gardening projects fail in Latin America. Africans are blessed because they do like green leaves, as a general rule. And so they are going to get a lot more nutrients than someone in Latin America. They're eating something. They're often they're eating things you don't pick up on a short visit. But yeah, there's no one thing. We probably have 100 different ideas in this book, and none of them will work if people simply say, we're totally happy with what we're doing and we don't want to change. So it's your life. But some of them will. Mm-hmm.